Welcome to the APM podcast. APM is the chartered body for the project profession. My name's Emma DeVita and I'm the editor of Project, APM's quarterly journal, and your host. In this podcast, I'm speaking to Steve Gilligan, a program manager who's playing a critical role in the world's first decommissioning of a nuclear fusion machine. He works in Culham campus just outside Oxford, which is home to the Joint European Torus, or JET, a tokamak machine where some of the world's most important nuclear fusion experiments have taken place. Astoundingly, the machine has housed the hottest temperatures in the solar system, yes, even hotter than the sun, and has proven that nuclear fusion, as opposed to fission, is a viable, sustainable and reliable energy source. But now, JET's days are over, and Gilligan is tasked with taking apart and reusing and retrieving valuable resources from the tokamak. Using robots through remote handling is a key part of his focus. Steve talked to me about what it's like working on such an exciting and world-leading project, why humour is key when it comes to high-risk project management environments, and why it's always worth celebrating those project milestones. Oh, and if you're interested in finding out more, read our in-depth look at JET and the decommissioning programme in the Spring 2024 issue of Project. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for joining us on the APM podcast. Would you mind giving us a very brief history of JET and also the decommissioning program and where you are with that right now?
So if you're not familiar with JET, JET stands for Joint European Torus. It's a large-scale fusion reactor. It's actually known as a tokamak, which is a Russian word that describes the type of machine, which is basically a design that uses very powerful magnetic fields to confine a plasma. The machine is in the shape of a donut with all the auxiliary systems around it, and it uses mostly deuterium and tritium as fuels. The JET design was actually initiated in 1969 after a visit by UK-based scientists to visit a machine in Russia. And they realised that the tokamak was likely to be very successful. And then in 1977, Culham was chosen as the host site for a European machine. So since 1977, the machine was constructed. And it actually only took them 6 years to build the facility with the machine and to get to what is called the first plasma. So 6 years from 77 to 1983. JET was the first machine to achieve controlled fusion. And when it's running, the maximum temperature, it goes up to 150 million degrees centigrade, which at one point made JET the hottest point in the solar system. So it's quite a machine.
Hotter than the sun?
Yes, yeah. It's mind-boggling, really. The first time I saw the machine in, I think it was 2003, I just thought this is the stuff of madmen. Who came up with this? But it's worked. It's been operating since 1983. It's been through a number of refurbishments and upgrades to improve the capability to perform more science. It's set several world records. It's achieved through the science campaigns what it was set out to achieve, and actually much more. And it's paved the way for future fusion. So it's a very exciting machine to be working with.
So how does JET fit in with global research into fusion, and why has that been so important?
JET as a design for a number of reasons sets a benchmark. It's been used progressively over the years to prove magnetic confinement, the heating systems, the emissions, how you would monitor and control a machine, a future fusion device. And a lot of other machines that are in the pipeline are based on JET design in various forms. So, for example, the ITER machine that's being built at Cadarache in the south of France, there's a huge international collaboration It involves governments that represent half of the world's population to build this fusion reactor in the south of France that is based on a lot of what's been learned at JET. And even as we now head into the decommissioning phase for JET, JET isn't finished. It's just entering another phase. So ITER in France, the STEP device, which is a UK design, being built at West Burton. They're all learning from the history of JET over the last 40 years of operation, and they'll continue to learn as we decommission JET.
What has it felt like to be working there, working with the team, knowing how important this work has been? And is that part of the reason that drew you to work at JET?
Yeah, I actually first came to Culham in 2003. At that time, we were just preparing for what was called the enhanced performance shutdown. And this was to do a major upgrade of the JET machine that took 14 months. And that was working in the remote handling team. And it was incredibly exciting because the scale of the machine and the remote handling that we actually do here on site is world class. So it was really good being involved in that. And then since 2003, I've had various roles where I've been involved in other shutdowns. And then I spent 8 years at ITER in the south of France in the construction management team, and then came back to Culham in 2016. It's always had a draw, and being based here at Culham with what happens not just in JET but other programs and projects that we've got on site, all of it is really cutting edge and exciting to be involved in. There's not a day that's boring. There's always a new challenge, so it's always a good motivator to come on site and try and make fusion successful.
How important is fusion to kind of global energy production and the climate crisis, just for people who might not necessarily be aware of nuclear fusion and its potential?
Fusion has a huge potential to be another source of energy. We know that we've got solar, we know that we've got wind turbines. There's various opportunities to harness tidal power. We have nuclear fission. Nuclear fusion, along with these other sources of energy, they all have a role to play at some extent. But nuclear fusion is incredibly important because it is inherently much safer than fission, and the byproducts in terms of the fuel that's required and the waste products is much reduced. So, for example, with JET, the last record that it set was in 2023 in the last science campaign, and that created 69 megajoules of energy. So we had a sustained fusion reaction for 5 seconds, but that only used 0.2 milligrams of fuel. So that is a minuscule amount of fuel compared to being able to generate that amount of power from other sources. So from a sustainability point of view, fusion is very important. And like I said, it's another opportunity, and it's an opportunity that we should seize in order that we have a balanced supply of energy and we don't put all of our hopes in one solution. We need options going forward.
You're in the decommissioning phase. I'll talk about that in a sec, but is it very much you're handing the baton over to STEP and to ITER in France with the work that's been done at Culham?
Yeah, in terms of the science, a lot of what's being learned, the engineers and operators that have worked on JET over the last decades have now moved on to other projects, and STEP is one. We also have another device on site called MAST, which is the mega amp spherical tokamak, which is a smaller machine but that's also been very successful UK project. So the workforce has sort of diversified and is getting involved in other projects, all leading towards fusion as a future energy supply.
You know, the big question is, how close are we? How close could we be to achieving that?
So a lot of people laugh. Fusion is always in the future. I don't think that we've ever been closer to fusion than we are now. JET has proven that a fusion reaction is viable and it's sustainable. ITER in France will prove that you can get more energy out of the machine that you put in, so it will become commercially viable. And STEP, as a UK-based project at West Burton, as part of UKAEA, will prove that it's commercially viable and will build the first commercial reactor here in the UK. So I think we're very close, and the closeness of proving fusion as an energy source and the importance that is being given to it by UK and international government is also why there is so much investment. So over the last 10 or so years, there have been a lot of private fusion companies that have been established, and they're all working on various schemes. A lot of them are based on what's been proven at JET. And yeah, the investment and the interest is there because there is a motivation. We've got to make fusion work. It's getting closer.
This is hugely exciting, a hugely important project. And now it's being decommissioned, which is also a world first. So could you tell us a bit about the decommissioning program? I know it's only just begun. And also your role. So you're head of JET decommissioning and handling. So how does your role fit in within that program of decommissioning? And what are you responsible for?
So as head of decommissioning and handling, I'm responsible for decommissioning and handling of basically the tokamak and all of the auxiliary systems. So the JET machine is distributed, or the JET facility is distributed across a number of connected buildings. The machine itself is in a concrete bioshield where access is very much restricted, and then the systems branch out into other facilities. So what my team is working on is effectively the design for how we will decommission the JET machine. So we're having to work out, firstly, how it went together, considering that at the time it was mostly done through paper documents rather than electronic files.
Have you still got those paper documents?
Yeah, we fortunately do, but we're trying to work through archives. So we've got industrial archaeology going on to work out how the machine went together.
Is anyone still around who worked on that?
Yeah, we are quite fortunate that we have reached back to a number of engineers who were involved in the early days. And also as part of the JET decommissioning program, we've actually onboarded a lot of engineers who are involved in the operation of the machine. So there's a lot of knowledge, personal knowledge, that we've taken on board as part of the team.
So you haven't gone back to the Russians, you must have.
No, not that far back. So we're having to go through this industrial archaeology to reverse engineer the machine, to work out how to take it apart. And then in doing so, we're having to schedule all the work. The decommissioning will be done under CDM, Construction Design and Management Regulations, as well as ionizing radiation regs and so on. So we're having to work out how to decommission the machine safely. All of our contracting strategy, new capabilities that are needed, because as part of decommissioning, we don't just want to take the machine apart and dispose of hundreds of thousands of tonne of material as waste. What we're trying to do is intelligence being applied to decommission the machine so that we repurpose as much of the equipment as possible. So, you know, we want to use some of the equipment for future science experiments on site or with other collaborators in Europe. We want to recycle the material so they go back into the supply chain. And we also want to recover as much of the tritium, the fuel, as we can, because it's not waste. It's a fuel. It can be used in future devices. So we're trying to do, you know, apply an intelligent approach to decommission the machine. And in doing so, we've got connections with, for example, the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, because we're using this site as a lead and learn.
So am I right in thinking that a decommissioning of a tokamak at this scale has never been done before?
No, nobody has decommissioned a facility on the size of JET before for fusion. It's not only a first of a kind project, it's also the only project of its type that we will have the opportunity to learn from in the next 20 or more years. So it's the timing of it is really important, because it can feed into the design for ITER, for STEP, and so on. So there's a lot of interest growing about what can be learned from decommissioning JET, because it will help with the design of the next generation.
How does that make you feel personally to work on a project on something no one's ever done before? Is it exciting, daunting, terrifying?
I don't wake up every morning thinking I'm going to change the world. It's a job. It's a really exciting job. And the people that I get to work with are really intelligent and really motivated. I guess it's only when you sort of step back, when we've achieved a major milestone, that you think, yeah, that is really good. We've made a difference here. But otherwise, you know, I'm sure a lot of listeners will, you sort of get into the day job where you're constantly churning through the problems, trying to find solutions and so on. It's only when you sort of step back that you think, yeah, hold on, this is, you can tend to lose sight of the bigger picture.
In terms of project management, what have been the biggest challenges that you kind of face in the job at the moment?
Because this is a first of a kind project, we're also applying first of a kind technology. So I mentioned remote handling earlier. So since the mid 1980s, JET has had a large scale remote handling system where we use dexterous manipulators.
Do you mean robots?
Yes, robots within the machine. That's been a proven system. We've already operated for about 60,000 hours since the machine was, the remote handling system became operational. But the amount of remote handling that we will do in JET to decommission it is going to be of a larger scale. In doing so, we're also developing a lot of new technologies. So, for example, we're going to be deploying large-scale cutting devices into the machine with sort of meter diameter circular saws deployed robotically to cut up copper coils. We've got laser cutting. We're going to be using a very high power laser to cut steel away. And this hasn't been done before, not on the scale that we're looking at in JET.
And so I remember when I came on site that there was a replica of the tokamak where they were using some of the remote handling on that. Is that how you learn how to do it before you actually go in? How important is that?
Yeah, so we have a full-scale test facility so that when the remote handling system isn't operating on the JET machine itself, the operators can develop their tasks and do training, document their procedures, their safe system of work. So we always go through a very thorough process of performing trials in a virtual reality system before we then do task training, trials, and then once everything is proven, we then deploy and do the task inside the vessel. So that's a major piece of work that we'll be doing over the next 5 or so years.
We're APM, the only chartered membership organisation for the project profession. When you become an APM member, you'll receive the resources and support you need to make an impact, delivering better projects with better outcomes. Plus, you'll access exclusive training and benefits to support your ongoing career development. Find out how we can help you reach your potential by visiting apm.org.uk. Because when projects succeed, society benefits.
Could you give listeners a description of the tokamak? It's quite hard to do, but could you give them an idea of what it actually looks like and how big it is?
Okay, so if you were to imagine a donut with a hole in the middle, that's what the tokamak is a donut. But instead of having the tasty pastry and so on inside, it's a vacuum chamber or vacuum vessel.
And what's it lined in?
So it's a vacuum vessel with several layers, which provide the containment for the gases. It maintains a vacuum and it maintains the plasma. The plasma, as mentioned earlier, the machine will get up to 150 million degrees. So you have to contain that plasma within what's called a first wall. And that first wall comprises tile assemblies, which are made out of either beryllium or carbon fiber composite, or tungsten, or tungsten-coated carbon fiber composite. And those tiles are able to contain the plasma in conjunction with the magnetic field. So in theory, the plasma shouldn't touch the tiles, but they will constantly erode as the machine is operating. The plasma is contained by magnetic fields, which are arranged around all of the tokamak section, or if you took a slice through the donut.
When I went on site, I saw it from afar, and I saw the replica where you used to test and train. But if you were to go into the tokamak, how long would it take you to walk around it, do you think? Have you ever tried it?
I have been inside the machine in, I think it was 2004. Previously, dependent on the dose rate exposure to operators, we have been able to put personnel into the machine for short duration tasks. You basically crawl through a chute into the machine through a horizontal port that's sort of midway up the outer wall through an access facility. And you could do some tasks within the vessel, but your entry is limited to several hours, and it really isn't a pleasant experience, because you're wearing several layers of undergarments within a rubberized, pressurized suit where you've got breathing hoses and so on trailing behind you. It makes a really interesting weight loss program, because when you come out, you can tip the suit and all of the sweat pours out of it. But since then, the machine has become more and more activated, and we've increased the operation. So the reason that we're going to deploy remote handling systems going forward is that the predictions on the exposure to operators is that to decommission the machine, we wouldn't be able to put personnel in for 35 years since it stopped operating. So we don't really want to have a very long care and maintenance period. What we want to do is decommission as quickly and as safely as we can. And that means that we will use remote handling and robotics wherever we can justify the investment.
So, I mean, that's one of the challenges, right? The kind of technological side of things. What other challenges exist? Like, I guess the safety as well is obviously predominantly important.
Yeah. So JET isn't a licensed nuclear site, but we have significant hazards. We have the radiation. We have tritium, the fuel, the off gases. The beryllium that's used within the machine is highly toxic. We have mercury and other materials on site, some fairly exotic materials that we can't handle. And even now, while we're in an engineering and planning phase for some areas, we've actually just started to do the first major decommissioning activity, which is to isolate and then remove all of the high voltage power supplies. So even this in its own right as a first activity, it's 63 transformers, which are very large pieces of equipment with all the associated power cabling and control units and so on. And there's 500,000 litres of oil that we've got to try and recover from inside these transformers. So everything is really large scale, and you know there's hazards associated with everything we're doing, which is why we're trying to take a very disciplined engineering and management approach to the work.
Is this kind of massive problem solving part of what you relish about the role?
Yes, it is. There's nothing on this site that you can say is just standalone and you can just deal with one thing. The power supplies that I just mentioned, we're going to decommission two facilities, but they're connected to another dozen facilities. So we've got to work out how we can bypass some of the power supplies and put additional loops in while we're decommissioning others. There's nothing is simple about any of it. So every day there's a new challenge that we need to work out how we're going to overcome it. And that's part of the excitement about being on a project like this.
Do you have a particular project management approach when it comes to people on projects? And is that something you find motivating to work with? I mean, obviously such talented, interesting international experts.
So, yeah, I mean, we have a very broad mix of people on site. We have quite a large international community because JET was a European project. And as things have progressed, we've brought in a lot of international collaborators. We have a very motivated workforce, and everybody who is here on site everybody comes across as being motivated to help solve the fusion challenge in one form or another. And that is really good to work with people, because despite the challenges that we have, there's a lot of motivation to try and solve those challenges, even if people go above and beyond working in their own time to think about problems and then bring them back into the workplace. But in terms of trying to manage this as well, the intelligent workforce and the high degree of enthusiasm also brings its own challenges, because sometimes you need to rein people back in to say that's great, but we don't need to worry about the problem in 3 years' time today. We need to focus on the problem that we've got today and tomorrow. So it's trying to bring things back to, we've got a plan, we know what we've got to deal with now, we'll park other things and deal with them in the future. So managing the workforce is really interesting, because you know sometimes there can be an over motivation to succeed.
Well, I guess that must be there's probably people listening thinking, I wish we had that problem.
it's a nice problem to have, but it's generally a pleasant environment, and say people are motivated.
Do you have a particular approach to management? How do you manage the teams that you oversee?
I will be as direct as I need to be in terms of setting priorities and goals and target dates. Because I'm also an engineer as well as a program manager, I'll help the engineering team and try and solve some of the problems that we have as we go through them. But once I've sort of set out what the vision is, I am very much reliant on a strong project controls team that we have to work through, develop the detailed schedules to achieve the strategy or vision that's been set out, and then to help the team to deliver it once we've got that schedule and cost baseline in place. But what I don't do is step back. I still like to very much get involved in the detail, and where we have problems, try and help the team to solve them.
So you're very much a manager, project manager, who would be walking around the office just being part of the team?
Yeah. Yeah. So I work in a large open plan office. My team is about 120 people, of which roughly half are within the building that I'm based in. But I try and make sure that I'm always visible. I'm not shut away in an office on my own. If anybody wants to come and talk through something, I'm available, or I'll walk over and just have a chat with people, see how they're getting on with different things. But yeah, I just try to make sure that I'm available and approachable, and you know that I'm part of the team, and also try and bring a bit of humour into things as well, because you know we are under some pressure. We have got a job to do, but it also needs to be an enjoyable place to work. So that's important, that the team knows that I'm approachable, and there has to be a bit of humour as well.
No, and that's such interesting management advice, because what's instantly springing to mind is when I interviewed Bill Ox, who was a NASA programme manager, and he told me how important humour was in these extremely, you know, highly pressurised projects where if something goes wrong, it's a really big deal. So humour is a natural way to keep the team functioning and people happy.
It is important. It is important. We're in a serious business. We are dealing with a high hazard environment, but also now and again, you just have to interject a bit of humour, just take a little bit of pressure off, and it also helps to form the team.
An important question I wanted to ask you would be, what have been the lessons around programme and project management that you've learned working where you do now that perhaps you'd wish you could have told a younger self?
Everything that I've done for the last 20 or so years since I've been involved in Fusion has been first of a kind. No matter how much you can try and relate a new project to something that you've done before, every project is different. And I think it's important to learn that no matter how well you think you've planned the work, and how much you've divested energy into risk management and so on, and trying to make sure that you've got a good team, there are always things that are going to trip you up. So trying to really just make sure that you've got enough contingency on a first of a kind project, and that you're always trying to anticipate the risk occurring. You can never step back and say, I've got a plan, I'm just delivering to the plan. You need to really keep looking ahead at what's going to potentially trip you up in a month's time, 3 months' time, 6 months, 12 months, and just keep anticipating the issues and make sure you've got enough contingency to address those.
Any other words of wisdom?
Yeah, enjoy projects. I think it's important. You have to enjoy them. Don't take a project as just being a day job. Projects can be very, very enjoyable when you've got a team that's motivated and are all pulling in the same direction.
What bit of a project do you enjoy the most?
The party when it closes.
So you've had some good parties.
No, we've had a lot of successes along the way, and I think the part that I really do enjoy is when there's an opportunity to recognise what people have accomplished. Even as we've been developing the remote handling upgrades, we completed a major development program that took 4 years to design this new control system. And that involved over 100 people working for a long period, extended days and so on. And to be able to step back for a day, organise a bit of an event for them, and to just socialise and give them the recognition for having accomplished a huge amount to get to that point. And we hadn't finished at that point, but it was just an opportunity to say thank you to people for what they'd done. And I think that's important.
Was there anything else you wanted to add? I did want to ask you whether you had any interesting anecdotes from working that you're able to share.
What I would say is that, you know, Culham, the site here where Jet has been hosted is a great site. There's a lot of interesting personalities. There's a lot of passion about what we do. And, you know, going forward, Fusion is an industry to watch. I think there are huge opportunities, and it will be a future viable energy source. And I hope the listeners are interested and will follow the progress of the decommissioning program.
Well, definitely, we'd love to catch up with you regularly to see how things are going. So it just leaves me to say thank you for your time and sharing your advice. Really appreciated. Thank you.
No problem at all. Thank you for inviting me to speak with you.
Thanks again to Steve for joining us and to you for listening to the APM podcast. Don't forget to look out for more episodes or to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. We'd welcome you to get in touch with your comments, feedback and suggestions by emailing us at apmpodcast@thinkpublishing.co.uk. This podcast has been brought to you by APM, the chartered body for the project profession. For more information on APM, visit apm.org.uk.